Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Coach Baseball Right podcast. I'm your host and founder of Coach Baseball Right, Steve Nicolarat. Join us as we go inside, outside, and all around baseball, discussing how to coach baseball the right way. In today's Coach Baseball Rights podcast, I'm really excited to share with you our interview with longtime Major League Baseball umpire Jerry Davis. Jerry has umpired in the big leagues for 38 years. He's been a crew chief since 1999. He has umpired 5 World Series, 9 League Championship Series, and 11 League Division Series. He's also worked the All-Star Game 4 times. During this interview, I got a chance to ask Jerry about his journey to the big leagues, his take on instant replay, and what really happens in New York during the replay, and how he feels about the K-zone box, or the strike zone box, that we see on TV. Sit back and enjoy our behind-the-scenes interview with Major League umpire Jerry Davis.
Hi, everybody. We are here with Jerry Davis, Major League umpire for over 38 years. Jerry, thanks so much for being part of the Coach Baseball Right podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Steve. Great to be here.
Jerry, our Coach Baseball Right program is all about helping organizations, coaches, and parents transform baseball experiences and developments. We started this podcast to allow our listeners to hear different perspectives on coaching baseball the right way. So with that being said, let's jump into our first question. 1976, St. Louis, Missouri, you decide to attend Al Summers Umpire School. Had you ever umpired before?
Interesting enough, I played for Paul Fultz, St. Louis Pros. We had a traveling team, and I had hurt my arm and couldn't pitch. And whenever we would travel for games, we would provide one of the umpires, and the home team would provide one. Well, Paul said, since you're hurt and can't pitch, you're going to be the umpire. And that literally was so he could save the $8 or $10, whatever it was we were paying the guys back then. I did it, and he said, hey, you know, you're pretty decent. You should think about going to umpire school. And quite frankly, I didn't really even know there was such a thing. I grew up like every red-blooded kid. I wanted to be a major league player. But he sent away for the application and had it sent to my house. And it was at a time in my life when I, you know, was able to drop things and go to umpire school. So I decided to go, and obviously things have worked out pretty great for me.
You sure have. Paul was a wonderful guy, and I can see Paul doing that, trying to save a few dollars and at the same time give a guy a start. So that's pretty cool.
He was a classic, and I'll tell you, you know, from a coach's perspective, had such an influence on so many young guys' lives. I mean, he was a great person. He really, really was.
Hey Jerry, what was umpire school like?
Well, it was competitive. I mean, you know, you go down there blind and really not knowing what to expect, but it's very intense. The year that I went to school, there were 3 schools combined, and total there was 303 students. Of those 300, 14 of us got jobs out of umpire school, and then 3 of us made it to the major league. So it's very competitive to get out. And pretty intense while you're there as far as studying the rule book and, you know, learning positioning and timing and such.
Who were the other 2 fellows out of that class that got to the big leagues?
John Hirschbeck, who was in my class, and Tim McClellan.
After umpire school, your first job in pro ball, where did it take you to?
Sure, I was in the Midwest League. Fortunate enough, I finished first in my class, so I got to skip, back then, depending on where you finished in your class, you could skip rookie ball. So I went right to the Midwest League, umpired there for 2 years, and then to the Eastern League. And at the end of my 3rd year, went to the American Association and then to the major leagues.
Let's go back to the Midwest League. Do you remember your very first ejection?
I do. Juan Monasterio played for the Mets. They were the Wausau Mets at the time, and he was from Cuba and a little volatile. And I had called a strike on him that he didn't like. This was like my 3rd plate jobs in organized baseball, And then he popped up, and as soon as he popped up, he ran like three steps with the bat, turned around, and threw the bat at me. So that was kind of an easy one.
What was minor league baseball like for an umpire as you climbed the ladder? In other words, was it a different experience from one league to another?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing that I say about being in the minor leagues, and this is true whether you're an umpire or a player or coach, manager, really whatever, the one thing you have in common when you're in the minor leagues is that you don't want to be there. You know, you want to keep moving up, and quite frankly, back in those days, as an umpire, the way you moved up was you had to, like, quote unquote, win the argument. You know, you had to either yell louder than the other guy or have the last say, that kind of thing. So it was the mentality that you had to win the argument, which was, you know, I mean, it helped me to some extent, but the truth is once I made it to the major leagues, I you know, learned a lot, and that's not always how you win arguments.
Right. Hey, can you elaborate on, you know, a couple fun, interesting moments that occurred in the minor leagues?
Oh, well, geez. I mean, I remember one of the plays in particular. I was working with Christine Wren, who at the time was the only female umpire in baseball, and we had a game in Clinton, Iowa. It was the Dodgers farm club, and they had I remember Socha being there, and one of the pitchers with Oakland, he was the point is the lights were so terrible. I mean, you could barely see the outfielders. And we had a play late in the game where bases were loaded and nobody out, and the guy hit a shot into the gap in right center. And Christine went out on the ball, and the runners just started running, took off running and everything. And a couple guys scored, and she came running back in, signaling out, and nobody had seen her do that at first. So all the runners were scrambling back. I mean, it was a real cluster. It was crazy. We ended up getting a triple play and a protested game and three or four ejections over the whole thing. It was a real farce. I mean, crazy. That happened, and I remember in Dubuque, Iowa, the team had lost like 14 straight games or whatever and didn't want to play on a Sunday afternoon because we had a big travel day. So they put all the hoses under the tarps to water down the field. I mean, we got to the field the next day. It was 75 degrees, beautiful day, but we couldn't play because the field was waterlogged. So, I mean, those kinds of things were, you know, everything that you see like in Bull Durham and all those kinds of movies, they're all true. They all happen.
It really happened. That is incredible.
Really.
Now, whatever happened to Christine Wren? Did she continue her journey in the minor league ball?
She did not. I think I went to Double A from there, and I think that was her last year. I have not stayed in touch with her. I heard that she moved to Washington and was a UPS truck driver, but I have not stayed in touch with her.
So when you went to a league and were you given a partner for the season,
right,
for a month? How did it work?
Well, it was usually for a season, unless you had so much crap they decided to switch you. I mean, you know, it was kind of on the fly kind of thing. It the intent was for it to be for the season, and that's the way it usually happens.
And did you have a different boss in each league that you went to?
Yes. Yes. We had Mr. Walters, who was a fantastic league president in A-ball. I had another excellent league president in Pat McCurran, and then Joe Ryan. I was very fortunate in all my minor league career to have league presidents who were very, very supportive of umpires. Joe Ryan in particular, at the AAA level, back then, the major leagues, the National League and the American League, had to take options on your contract in order to purchase you. And once one took an option, the other couldn't claim you. So he scouted umpires, and consequently, the American Association had a lot of prospects that were going to be going to the major leagues. So he was really great, really a great league president.
Where were you when you were notified you were going to go to the big leagues? Do you remember the place?
Oh, absolutely. I, It was I remember the place, the hotel room. It was 2:19 in the afternoon. Yeah, it was in Wichita, Kansas, 1982. You know, that's obviously the culmination of you know, your career dreams. So, sure, those are the kinds of things that stick out in your mind.
And who made that call? How were you informed?
At the time, the director of umpiring was Ed Vargo. He called me and said that I had to be in Montreal for the following game. And interesting enough, they were playing the Cardinals. You know, my being from St. Louis was a very special day.
Oh, that's awesome. So your first major league was the Expos and the Cardinals.
Yes.
And you remember your partners that day?
Oh, absolutely. And another thing to show you how old I am, I guess. I went in because Doug Harvey's father was ill, and Doug Harvey had to leave. So that tells you how long ago it was. But my partners were Frank Pulley, Nick Colosi, and Jerry Crawford. And a little antidote to that, I worked third base, and my first call was like in the fourth or fifth inning. I called somebody out at third base, and it was the last out of the inning. And back then, they just rolled the ball to the mound. Jerry Crawford was umpiring first base, and he went in from first base, got the ball, and rolled it over to me. So it was my first call in the major leagues. I still have the baseball from.
Oh, that's neat. Now, is he still umpiring?
He's not. He's retired. No.
And how long has he been retired?
I would guess 4 years, maybe. That would be a guess. 4 or 5 years, yeah.
And was Jerry, is he the son of Shax Crawford?
That's right. Yes, he is. They have a real officiating family because Jerry's brother, Joey, was a longtime Hall of Fame-type referee for the National Basketball Association.
Now, can you tell me, pick out some highlights, something that in your career really stands out?
Oh, well. Obviously, you know, my first game, I'll remember forever and stuff. My first World Series was obviously one that I refer to a lot. That was in 1996. That was the Yankees and the Braves. The Braves won the first two games in New York, and then we're headed back to Atlanta. So, you know, the feeling was this series is pretty much over because the Braves had, you know, unbelievable pitching back then and stuff. And the other thing that was a factor back then was that the rotation was different than it is now. The rotation was on seniority, and it was reverse seniority. So I was the youngest guy on the crew and scheduled to work game six. Obviously the Yankees won the first, those three games at Atlanta, and we had to go back to New York. So I had to work game six, but it was obviously something that stands out. I mean, it's a memory for a lifetime.
That's neat. Any particular crazy things happen in that World Series?
Let's see. One of the things that comes to mind is I know that Cox was really unhappy with Tim Waelke with his strike zone. And the next night, Tim was working right field. And, you know, we work a four-man system during the season. Six-man system, completely different. There's a pop-up over by first base, you know, between first base and the right fielder. And Tim is, you know, navigating his way between the second baseman and the first baseman, and the right fielder coming from behind ran into him and would have had a chance to catch it. So Cox went all nuts again and everything. But that was, you know,
part of the game.
It wasn't good, but at least the Braves won that game. At least.
Hey, you know, when you do something this long, and it's not an easy thing to do, there's got to be some difficult moments that you experience. Would you mind sharing a few of those with us?
Well, sure. I mean, regardless of the persona that we, you know, we try to emit, the truth is that, you know, we miss plays. We're human. The most difficult thing, obviously, of our job is the travel. I mean, we do 120 games a year, which in and of itself is difficult. But when you combine that's every 3 or 4, you know, that's 3 or 4 days at a time before you travel. And anyone who travels for a living, I mean, anyone who thinks traveling is glamorous doesn't have to travel for a living. I mean, you know, unlike the players who have charters, we have we fly commercially, so we're involved in all those flight delays and the room reservations being screwed up, and you know, we're human, you know, and those things make it really difficult. The idea of all the travel and being away from their family is very difficult.
Have you ever arrived at a site and didn't have your equipment?
Yes, actually, that happened to us in Philadelphia, and you know, we kind of put a hodgepodge together and stuff with some dark pants and things like that. I mean, it's really amazing with all the travel that we do that it doesn't happen more frequently. And only until, like, maybe, I want to say 6 or 7 years ago, we didn't have any extra uniforms. Now, at least there's an extra trunk there that, you know, has several uniforms in it so we can try to patchwork things together. But back in the day, we just had a makeshift our own.
You know, Jerry, when you think about your career and like most officials, there's always guys along the way that seem to help you from the umpiring ranks. Who were the guys that you would say, hey, these fellas really had a special place in your career?
Sure. All three were crew chiefs. The first was Bruce Fermi. Bruce, quote-unquote, discovered me at Vero Beach when I was in A-ball working on one of the backfields. I mean, they were scheduled to do the Major League game there at 1 o'clock, and we had a game at 11 on one of the backfields, and he came back and watched. I was working the plate, and he was influential in my being looked at by the National League. You know, and I kind of adopted Bruce's way of umpiring. I mean, I was a real red ass in the minor leagues and yelled and stuff like that. But then when I made it to the major leagues, I was fortunate enough to work with Doug Harvey for a long time, and Doug's philosophy was different. His was to let your work, you know, speak for you. And so now I think I'm a little bit of a combination of the two. And the other crew chief that comes to mind is Terry Tata. Terry was and still is a really class guy that loved the profession. We did a lot of dining and seeing sights and things like that and stuff. So I'd say those three probably had the most influence on me.
Hey, when you go to spring training or when umpires go to spring training, what's spring training like for an umpire compared to a player? I mean, what do you do down there? Do you have to do anything special to get ready, or you just go out and umpire games?
We just go and do the games. Now, if you have – we have our meetings coming up the 22nd through 25th of January. And if there's – you know, if you're nicked up or bruised or whatever, anything that you might have wrong, they have a rehab facility. I go to Arizona every year. They have a rehab facility there and in Florida where the umpires can go there in the mornings before their games if they need to. But generally speaking, you go there, you do the games. I stay in Scottsdale, and because of seniority, probably have the least amount of travel. I most of my games are in the vicinity where, you know, it's less than 35, 45 minutes to my games. And the thing that's nice, too, is that the vast majority of our games are day games during spring training. So, you know, you get to live like a regular human during the spring and go to dinner and things like that.
Hey, during the baseball season, you live out in San Diego, is that correct?
I live in Huntington Beach. It's between Los Angeles and San Diego, yeah.
So how many games can you work within driving distance of your home?
Well, that's one of the things that is another advantage because of seniority. We bid on our schedules in its entirety by crew chief seniority. So consequently, I bid on schedules that have a lot of games in for Dodgers, Angels, and Padres. So I'm going to get an extra, you know, two or three series probably in each city for that reason, because it's, you know, I mean, it's less travel, and it's nice to put your head on your own pillow, you know, instead of being on the road.
So that takes me to this question. If you're on the road, okay, you're in the middle of a long road trip, so to speak, what's a typical day like for a major league umpire who's got an evening game?
Well, Actually, most of our days revolve around the travel. We're either traveling into the city or preparing and making sure our flights are all copacetic and stuff to fly out of the city. When it's, you know, mid-series or whatever, a lot of guys play golf, a lot of guys work out, a lot of guys play tourists. I mean, you know, the general kind of thing that you would expect. We have to be at the ballpark like maybe an hour 15 to an hour and a half before game time. But that's it, you know, that's it during the season.
Now let's talk a little bit about that strike zone. when we watch a game on TV now, we have a strike zone box, so to speak. And I guess it's pretty much for almost any game that we see. First of all, would you say that box, the one that the fans see, is it accurate?
Absolutely not. And I think the vast majority of the fans and even the players to a great extent now realize that that's not the case. That's a one-dimensional square on there. It's not three-dimensional at all. And you know, the rule is if any part touches any part of the ball touches any part of the plate, and you can't tell that in one dimension.
So when you guys are actually graded, what kind of a system are you? I'm assuming you guys are graded on every pitch. Does Major League Baseball use?
They have their own system that is three-dimensional. There are, I want to say like six different camera angles that they use so they can calibrate all of that, and we're graded on every pitch. And the interesting thing is that, you know, we're from the worst umpire to the best umpire as far as accuracy is concerned. There's less than one percentage point of difference.
Wow.
One of the things that MLB wanted to accomplish by combining the staffs was to uniform our strike zone, and I don't think there's any question that they've done that. So that, relatively speaking, when a pitch is a strike in the third inning on Tuesday, it's going to be a strike in the seventh inning on Friday. You know, that's the intent behind it, and I think for the most part they've accomplished that.
The thing is,
Steve, is that you know, as we well know, I may miss a pitch in the third inning, and it doesn't have the same bearing on the game that something that's in the bottom of the ninth. You know, so
right.
You may miss the same number of pitches, but when you miss them, you know, it's a factor as well.
So in a typical game, what do you think you see? 300 pitches a game, more or less?
Yeah, 300, yeah. That's the average, yeah.
So to have a good night, what would a good night be for a Major League umpire? You know, how many of those are you going to get right?
Well, if you're this is a Z, it's a ZE system. If your ZE system is below 96%, you're not very happy.
And the typical, I mean, do you know before you even look at the using the tool that they provide? Do you know you've had a great night? You know you've had a night that you wished you had a few more back.
Sure you do. Absolutely you do. I mean, we're human. We're going to make mistakes, and you're aware when that happens, for sure.
Let's talk about instant replay. How do umpires feel about replay?
I think if you were to survey the guys, the vast majority would be pleased with it. I think that it's, you know, the main thing from our perspective is we want to get it right. We don't want to play named after us. Okay, everybody, obviously, everybody knows about the Don Dinkinger play. All right, everybody knows about the Jim Joyce play or the Richie Garcia play. You know, I don't want a play to be named after me. You know, and
right.
while that is still possible, it's, you know, the likelihood does decrease because of replay. I mean, Dinkinger is a perfect example. I mean, Don was one of the all-time great umpires we ever had, and you know, he's remembered obviously for the play in St. Louis in 1985. Well, 6 years later, he worked Game 7 behind the plate in '91 with the 1-0 game between Smoltz and Jack Morris. Was phenomenal, and unless you were an umpire, you don't remember that at all. I mean, I've been you know, I've been to dinner and out with Don a number of times, and whenever he's introduced, you know, it's, hey, aren't you the guy? You know, and that's something that he's got to live with, you know, forever. When, you know, the truth is, he was one of the best we ever had.
This podcast is powered by E3 Consultants Group. E3 wants to awaken the inner entrepreneur in anyone who is ready to take control of their financial picture. E3's family office model is prepared to serve individuals, families, and business owners with the right mindset, regardless of your net worth. E3 Consultants Group believes it's time for a new age of enlightenment. People need people to take responsibility for their financial well-being. The problem rests with inactivity, in sitting back and doing nothing. Essentially, we've allowed an entitlement society to overtake our ability to succeed or fail on our own merits. If you are ready to equip yourself with the knowledge and strategies to break out of this cycle and take your financial picture to the next level, then E3's business model is ready to assist you in thinking differently. If you are an entrepreneur, who is helping you get to the next level? Are there financial roadblocks standing in your way? At E3 Consultants Group, their mindset is all about optimizing the tools of time, talent, and capital. Whether it happens through cash flow awareness, income tax strategies, business consulting, privatized banking strategies, wealth management, or asset protection, E3 is ready to take your mindset from worry to wealth to worthiness. John Moriarty, the founder and president of E3, is a longtime supporter of Coach Baseball Right. Visit their websites, www.e3cg.com or www.e3wealth.com, or contact John Moriarty directly at 314-805-9349 to learn more. Tell him Coach Nicolarot sent you. It's time to think differently. E3 Consultants Group, education, empower, enlighten.
Hey, can you explain when the umpires put on their headsets and they go to New York, can you explain like how it works, the room up there and where the umpires, what they're doing and how many umpires are up there and the yeah. communication between the guys on the field and the guys in New York? Can you go through that process?
Right. Well, first of all, there are two crews in New York in the replay each week. And you're assigned a shift, different games week to week. And when you have a replay, the other game that you have shifts to another umpire. So you never have, you know, two replays at a time. The thing that's so drastically different, I mean, when you're on the field and you miss a play, I mean, you feel really bad about it. And a lot of times you're confident that you didn't miss the play. You know, so, but then when you go to the replay system, I mean, they have 12 angles. They have six angles from the home club, six angles from the visiting club. So 12 different angles, slow mo in every one of them. So when you see what is capable, what the replay is really capable of, it changes your attitude about, you know, the calls that you miss. I mean, obviously we want to know why. All right. I want to know if my positioning was wrong, if my timing was too quick, or if I missed the play because I'm human and I'm going to miss those plays. But it is a self-evaluating process, you know, when they come back and say, yeah, we have to overturn that. But the protocol itself is that the crew chief gets on the phone, gets on the headset, says, hello, New York, can you hear me? Make sure all the system's working, everything. As an example, the Reds are challenging the call at second base, which is safe. The reply is, okay, we'll take a look at it. They look at all those angles and get back to us with the decision. So we don't really have much input into that decision unless it was something like, I thought he beat it at first, but then he came off the bag, or, you know, something to that effect. But generally speaking, the decision is made in the replay booth.
And is there any concern at all from the guy who, well, first of all, the guy's in New York. Is just one guy going to make that call in New York, or is there a, you said there's a crew of guys that are in the room. You know,
that's
is there
true.
multiple guys?
There's one guy who's ultimately who is ultimately responsible for that decision. But it is a consensus for sure. I mean, there'll be guys that, you know, you're looking at something and another guy will say, wait, I think he came off the bag on the backside there or something like that. And then I'll look at it again, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a consensus, but it's one person who's ultimately responsible for making that decision.
Is there any concern at all about if the guy on the field who made the call is a senior umpire, an experienced guy?
No, absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. Our total objective is to get the call correct.
Does it ever cause humanness? You think that you got it right, and you saw that you're standing there in the field, and it looks to me, hey, I've got that one right, and it comes
sure.
back the wrong way. Does it tick you off a little bit, or?
Of course it does. But as I mentioned earlier. You may feel that way until you actually go through New York and see the different angles that they show. And invariably, because we have access to that afterwards, able to look at our calls again. And invariably, when you go back and look at the angles that they're able to see, you are forced to agree with them.
Wow. A few years ago, there was a play. It was about the slide rule. And it was, the on the field, they called the guy going home. They called him out, and it went to New York, and they reversed it. And it was just one of those plays where I guess what made it really more difficult than anything, it was the first year, I think, of the new rule interpretation. Can you go over what that rule is?
Well, obviously, it's been referred to as the Buster Posey rule. He hates that it's called that, but that is how it evolved. And the whole intent is that you don't want the runner to leave his running path, not necessarily a baseline, but his running path in his attempt to score. And if he deviates his path. And initiates contact, then he's going to be out regardless. There are, and you don't want the catcher to be able to quote-unquote block the plate, and that's obviously up for interpretation as well, but you don't want him to be able to block the plate unless he is either in possession of or in the process of fielding the throw. So that's basically the gist of the rule. But obviously there are different interpretations of it. I understand the fans' frustration. I mean, I'm a big Green Bay Packer fan, okay? So I see a lot of times where I can't believe how that decision came back. But with that being said, I mean, the vast majority of times, if we don't get it correct on the field, it's corrected by replay. And consequently doesn't have an adverse effect on the game.
Has replay changed, say, the skill set of an umpire? And I guess what I'm thinking about there is it seems to me that in the old days without replay, you could be umpiring the bases and you could have something crazy happen at any time, whether you're behind mm-hmm. the plate or on the bases. And it seems today there's not nearly as much of that takes place. Has that changed the skill set of an umpire in handling situations?
Well, for one thing, the handling situation thing, is that's an easy thing because there aren't as many situations anymore. I mean, years ago, runner would slide into second, you call him out, he pops up, throws his helmet down, and gets in your face, and here comes the manager, and you have a situation to handle. Nowadays, when you call him out at second, all he does is point to the dugout and put his hands on his ears, telling them to go to replay. So there are quite a few less situations that develop because in the first scenario, obviously a lot of things can change when you reject a guy and he goes crazy and you're back at him and all the things that, that occur with that. And those things, while they happen sometimes, don't happen with the same regularity that, you know, they used to years ago. As far as the skill set, one of the things that I see myself doing for sure is especially true on steal plays, you know, because now you see a number of times where a guy will slide into the second and he's safe, but his momentum will cause him to rise above the base by a couple inches,
mm-hmm.
and the player keeps the tag on, and in replay that's reversed to an out. So I find myself, you know, at least attempting to see if I feel he may have come off the base where, you know, before it was if he beat the throw, you know, he was pretty much safe. But now I'm conscious of paying a much more closer attention to see if he comes off the base.
So I guess that affects your timing a little bit.
Exactly.
Can you explain the procedure that you guys use when teams start to throw at each other?
Well, obviously, from an intent standpoint, we want to try to protect the players. There's no allowing the guys to get back at, you know, that, well, he hit my guy, so I should be able to hit him and all that stuff. Our objective is to protect the players and to stop the situation from escalating. And, again, I can understand the fans' frustration for that very reason, because probably their best player just got hit and nothing was done. And then as soon as their pitcher hits the guy, there's a warning or an ejection and things like that. I can understand that frustration, but the intent behind it is to try to stop situations from, you know, from getting out of hand.
Yeah, I think you and I and most umpires, all umpires, and I think most fans would agree that umpiring is pretty darn good. But how is it?
I'll agree with Steve. You got me there.
Is there a way we can improve umpiring? You know, we're all trying to improve, whether we're coaches, we're players, we're broadcasters. Everyone's trying to improve their skill set. How do we go about improving umpiring?
I think we've taken a lot of the steps to do that from, you know, we mentioned earlier that I've been around a long time and stuff. And you know, in the past, the case was when you made a call, if you were blocked out or the guy dropped the ball or whatever, that didn't really matter. You had to die with that call. And that's not the case now. I think we as crews around baseball get together and discuss things far more than we ever did. And obviously we have replay that, you know, takes care of the majority of those things. So I think things are going in that direction. I think there's room for continuing education that we should look at, you know, to keep things going in the right direction.
How would you say the game has changed in your 38 years? What have you seen?
Well, I don't think there's any question it's the specialization of the pitching. I mean, and we're in the midst of a change in that regard now as well, as far as, you know, the opener and staff of relievers and things like that. But for, you know, when I first went to the major leagues, if you were in the bullpen, it was simply because you weren't good enough to be a starter. That was the reasoning behind it. And now they've evolved from, you know, Whitey Herzog started the closer kind of aspect that Tony La Russa took to another level. But now there's not only the specialization of, you know, a lefty versus lefty kind of setup, but now managers are recognizing that a game can be saved. Doesn't have to be the ninth inning to save the game. You know, if the meat of the order is coming up in the seventh, you bring in what you feel is your best matchup in the seventh inning instead of waiting till the ninth inning. So the specialization is what's really changed the game, and consequently is what caused the lengthening of the games. I mean, again, you don't see pitchers pitching into the sixth or seventh inning that much anymore. And I mean, years ago, the average number of pitchers was like 5.2, and now it's 8.2. You know, when you have three more pitching changes a game, you're going to have longer games.
You know, I remember a little kid, I'd go and watch Bob Gibson pitch against Juan Marichal or Fergie Jenkins, and you know, you'd have a 2-1 hour and 35-minute game. And those were great days. Hey, let me ask you this. The future of umpiring, I mean, what do you see more technology coming in? What's the future of umpiring as it comes to technology? Where are we going?
Well, I think it's possible. I think, you know, those things are being explored. I know, you know, the electronic strike zone has been in the news the last couple of years. But, you know, the truth is I think there would be a lot more frustration with that, to be honest with you. I mean, if you had a little, you know, chip in the ball, for example, and I mean, there are pitchers at the major league level who can throw a pitch that will bounce on home plate and cross the strike zone. You know, and imagine that happening. I mean, there are quite a few times where a catcher would have to lunge for a strike where now it's called a ball, where because that chip crossed the plate, it would be called a strike. So I think there would be a lot more frustration if we did evolve into that. But obviously those are things they're looking at. So, you know, those of us that said there'll never be replay, we don't say those things anymore.
Are they going to expand the use of replay in the future?
I don't know the answer to that either. I think, you know, for the most part, it's accomplished what they wanted it to. There are specific plays, interesting enough, that we as umpires want them to expand to. When they first implemented the system, it was, well, what are the plays that happen most frequently? You know, those are the ones that we want to replay, you know. So I think, unfortunately, what will occur is that it will take a situation that's on the monumental side, and then all of a sudden we'll have to – that'll be reviewable as well.
Hey, what does it take to be a great umpire?
Well, I think you know, the thing I refer to a lot is consistency, and the mistake that I think the average fan makes when we talk about consistency is that they think we're talking just about being consistent on balls and strikes and safes and outs and that kind of thing. But I think I take it a step further into having a consistency of demeanor, where the teams and players, managers, whoever, know that if they address you in a civil manner, that they're going to get, you know, a gentleman reply. So they have to know where the line in the sand is and that it's on a consistent basis. So I think to be a great umpire, you have to have a consistency of your demeanor.
Hey, what is it that fans don't know about umpires, but you wish that they did?
Well, actually, I think they're learning more. You know, I think replay, even before we used it as a decision-making process, replay, when it first became available, just for the fans to see the thing in slow motion, was very good for us, because years ago when we made a call that went against your team, we were just automatically wrong. It was, you know, kill the bump. But now, whenever there's a close play, it's interesting because the mindset of the average fan, which, interesting enough, the word fan is short for fanatic, but the mindset of the average fan is that, you know, they're usually right. You know, they do a pretty good job and stuff. And to allude back to one of the questions you asked earlier about the process of when we go to the headset, I can't tell you the number of times when we go to the headset and they're showing the slow motion replay on the scoreboard. We're looking in the stands, and half the people are saying safe, and half are saying out, and they're looking at it in slow motion.
Right.
So
right.
You know, so I think the mentality of the fan has changed in that regard, in that you know, they realize that when we do miss a play, and the players have really fallen into this category more and more, is that we miss the play because we missed it, and not because we're trying to stick it to somebody. And that's really changed the mindset, I think.
Hey, Jerry, I know we've got some people out here listening to the podcast. They're interested in umpiring. What would you recommend? What do you suggest? How do they get involved in umpiring?
Well, as I said, when I went to umpire school, I didn't even know there was such a thing. And for those that are, you know, that are that are thinking about it at all, I first would go to try to find out, trying to find some high school or college camps in your area to go and get a little sniff of it, see if it's something that you think you might enjoy. Go to a few of those, and if you still have that desire to do that, I certainly think it's a dream you should pursue. It's been a wonderful career for me and my family, and I've been just so blessed. So if you believe it's something that you want to do, then you should look up and see about going to one of the umpire schools.
Jerry, what's the future hold for you? What might you be interested in doing when the time comes for you to step away from umpiring?
Well, I've become involved with Little League International in the last couple of years. We are in the process of developing a junior outreach program to train junior umpires, and I'm really excited about that. I think that it's going to give me an opportunity to give something back to the profession by training those that are young and think they may want to be umpires. So that's an exciting thing for me.
Is there any possibility or any interest in maybe doing some work with Major League Baseball?
Well, sure. I mean, I know my personality well enough that I'm not really a cold turkey guy where I can, you know, decide to retire and, you know, not be a part of it. So it's something that I would, you know, certainly be interested in because I want to stay involved in the profession. I love it.
Any thoughts on youth baseball? Any thoughts on, the amount of games kids play? Any thoughts at all on that subject?
Well, I guess, my perspective would come from an umpire's point of view. One of the things that we're talking about at the Little League level is because we want to not only recruit and train umpires, but we also want to retain them. There are several programs around the country that require that managers, coaches, and parents become umpires and umpire a game or two in their respective districts. And I think that would go a long, long way to helping the parent realize what the umpire on the field is going through and put a different perspective on things for them as well.
Yeah, I think if they actually had to experience what the guys on the field have to go through when they umpire a game, I do think that parents and coaches would
yeah.
feel and a little bit different and treat the guys a little bit different during those difficult moments.
That's going to be a main factor in being able to retain umpires as well. I think around the country there's a mini crisis now as far as having enough officials. I know there are a lot of games that have to be moved to different days and things like that because there just aren't enough officials to go around, and that's a byproduct of what we're talking about.
We're clearly not getting the young athlete, the guy who just finishes his high school career. Those guys aren't going into officiating, and we need
to
do a better job.
That needs to change, and I think I think it would be incumbent apart, managers and coaches to do what Paul Fultz did for me. He knew I wanted to stay involved in baseball in some capacity if I could. Steer your kids toward that. If they're not going to be able to be a player and they love the game, this is a great way to stay involved in it.
Hey, Jerry, listen, thanks so much for your time this evening and being on our podcast. I know our listeners have really enjoyed our conversation. I want to just congratulate you on a personal level for your 38 years. You've certainly had a wonderful career, and not only the things that you've done, the level of officiating that you've achieved, but really how you do it and how you conduct yourself. I want to congratulate you on a great career, and I hope you have a many, many more years.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it very much. Good luck to everybody.
Hey, thanks, Jerry. Thanks again now, and we'll be in touch, okay?
I really enjoyed our conversation with Major League umpire Jerry Davis. We got a chance to discuss quite a bit in our interview. Instant replay, K-zone, strike zone box used on TV, and what it takes to be a good umpire. I hope you got the feeling like I did that these umpires want to do a great job and get the play right. That's the most important thing, is to get the play right. I hope we remember that in the games we coach. All umpires want to get it right. Coaches, when you go on that field to talk to an umpire, remember that everyone is watching. This is your time to teach the kids on your team and the other team how to have a discussion when two people don't agree. These are the teachable moments that we really want to take advantage of. Make sure you think about this beforehand, so when the opportunity arises, you can handle the situation the right way. Thanks for listening, and I want to ask everyone to please share the link to this Coach Baseball Right podcast episode on Facebook and Twitter.